Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
In 5, 4, 3.
Hey everybody, this is Danielle.
And this is Daniel.
And I'm Carla, and we are Hoosier Homicide,
a true crime podcast by Hoosiers for Hoosiers, or for anyone that doesn't know what a Hoosier is.
Whoa. I don't know what a Hoosier is. Do you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I do.
Great. We don't need to look anything up.
Go to Wikipedia and type in Alabama Hot Pocket.
No, don't do that.
And that'll tell you what a Hoosier is.
Just come listen to us. You'll find out.
Anyway, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is @HoosierHomicide. You can also download any episode you prefer off of Stitcher, Podbean, iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify.
We tell true crime stories with some random connection to our home state of Indiana. So come listen.
That's what she said.
For the love of God.
And for honest to goodness, stay out of the corn.
Pretty good.
Dumb and Busted Pop Quiz Hotshot.
Kay, hit me.
A pervy arsonist who has a weird thing for men's shoes.
Episode 5, Fire Starter.
Yes. Twins who box for work and murder for fun.
Episode 42, Cray Cray.
Yes. Last one. Creepiest creeper who terrorizes a family with handwritten letters.
Episode 39, Watch Out.
Hell yeah. For true crime stories of insane stupidity and exceptional genius, listen and subscribe to Dumb and Busted on iTunes, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Jen. Wow, that was terrible. Hi, Jen. Sorry. I'm in a good mood today.
Hey, come on.
No. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We're going to go shopping today, you and I. That's kind of fun.
I know, with the girls. Mm-hmm. Well, the one girl that is nice, the other one has hit teenage
years.
Psycho years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I got you.
But I don't want her to go. Not Camille's daughter, my other daughter. She's mean to me. Oh, Lord.
Two girls. I'm glad I have a boy and a girl.
I know why.
It's better. It really is.
Usually, it's amazing. Sometimes they get along so well, and you hear them laughing, and they're playing, and they're, you know, and then other times, the one's throwing the other against the wall, and they're crying, and
mine went through
screaming.
That, too, but since they're older now, they kind of, it's more just like, shut up. I hate you. And then they just don't talk. Yeah. So it works out well for me. I like it better. It's easier.
The youngest one is.
But I do. We'll tell you this, and this hurts my feelings. They will pair up against me. Like they'll talk in code or secret slang, whatever. And they'll be like, what are you guys talking about? And they're like, oh my God, Mom, nothing. And I'm like, oh, gosh.
Well, my youngest one is about to hit puberty. I can tell those hormones are just kind of starting to surge a little bit. Because
I love you. I hate you. I love you.
The eye rolls are there. So it's going to happen soon. So I think that's part of the.
May the force be with you. May the force be with you. You're going to need it. You're going to need it. So I got a story for you today.
Oh, good. I like stories.
Takes place in Missouri. Never heard of it. Shocked. I'll just say that.
Really?
Shocked.
Mm-hmm. More shocked than the Diana Delia?
Differently, but yes.
Because that was a little plot twist right there.
Yeah, yeah. This one has a little plot twist, too.
Okay.
And I kind of tried to frame it like that on purpose.
Kind of Dateline-ish, but without plagiarizing like others.
There's
get that little jab.
Cavite, Jen.
There's a cavite. Am I going to be enveloped in it?
You are.
Let me get my sundries from the pantry.
In the 1980s, farmers were dealing with an economic crisis that few had lived through before them. Many of the farmers had always lived on the money that was generated by the agriculture they grew, were now facing financial ruin. The center of this out-of-control hurricane-like crisis was right here in good old the Midwest Missouri, right?
Missouri.
Missouri. But like hurricanes, it starts at the center and then it ripples out from the middle point. There are many factors that led to this, and this is what I started looking up, because I was like, I kind of remember the farm crisis, but I don't remember why or how or where. Here's a little background for you. Yeah. So during the 1950s and 60s, farmers were living high off the hog, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were making lots of money. The U.S. was doing really well. Technology had started to really advance.
Post-World War II era. Everybody
That's
does
exactly
well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The boom.
They were
everything boomed. Mm-hmm. Babies. money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was huge, right?
It all came to head in the 80s.
Farmers were able to figure out through technology, like I said, it was getting better, how to get more product faster, easier, and cheaper. So the farms were able to build up a huge surplus of wheat, corn, soy, and other sought-after grains. It was around this time that the Soviet Union negotiated a multi-year contract for wheat and feed grains in 1962. And within a span of 2 years, wheat prices doubled, corn prices tripled. So farmers were meeting the demand with supply, and during the early 70s, farms were having some of their most prosperous years ever in the Midwest. Unfortunately, nothing lasts forever, Jen.
No, it doesn't. Sometimes it's fortunate, though.
In 1979, the Federal Reserve stepped in. They wanted to reduce inflation. Remember, we're talking about the gas and stuff like that. So the Federal Reserve tightened its monetary policy, causing interest rates to levels not seen since, you ready? The Civil War.
Really?
Right? The prime lending rate went from around 6.8% in 1976 to, I was shocked, 21.5% in 1981.
You're kidding.
So while this change in the economy affected everyone, it was farmers, their families, and rural banks that it was hit
right.
most severe. Farmers borrowed money from banks to buy equipment and land supplies. And with these rates being so high, the debt adding up and leaving them upside down on their land. So they could never be out from underneath it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like with all that stuff. Thousands of farm families defaulted on their loans and were forced off the land. Small towns virtually disappeared overnight as factories and businesses failed in these little towns and they moved out. Banks went bankrupt, leaving ghost towns where businesses around the Midwest once thrived. So by the time Congress decided it was time to intervene, it was the mid to late 1980s. Many farmers, families, and communities had already felt the damage that had been done to them, and it was almost like too little too late. But there was something good to come from all of this, and that was profound social, political, and economic reforms in the sector.
Oh, I was going to say probably some really good country songs were written about that.
I'm glad you bring that up, Jen. Mm-hmm. Seems like it was a lifetime ago, but while we were young, and we were in high school, Farm Aid 85. See,
oh,
don't you remember
right.
that?
I
told you.
Aid.
I knew you'd remember that.
It was right after Live Aid.
1985.
And Band-Aid. And
Willie Nelson.
And,
Neil Young, sorry, Charlie, Danny, all the little country singers, right? But Willie Nelson was really big into
little
this.
Country singers. Those were pretty big country singers.
You know
what I mean. I remember Farm Aid.
So I knew you would. Told
I remember
you.
The song, though.
It was country singers, so.
Yeah.
I don't really know if they had that. We are the world. We are the world. I don't think they had that, but I could be wrong. So the farm crisis of the 1980s and all that hit us very hard. So that's your social studies lesson for today.
I remember
You're
that
welcome.
Now.
All this got me thinking about the farmers. I remember a little bit of this because it was the mid-80s and the news stories and things like that. So I wanted to get in and think about how this affected. Many of these farmers had been farmers from their great-grandpa,
right.
grandpa, dad, them,
farmers.
Right? And they're losing it, right? They're losing this. And they're
selling
they have,
off their land.
And you know what else happens with all that? So I did some digging and I found a New York Times article. And it was dated from 1991, so it was kind of the end of this. And it stated that more than 900 male farmers in the upper Midwest committed suicide in the 80s due to the farm crisis. So
whilst, and you wondered if they did it for depression or to try to save their families. Because, a lot of people think if they commit suicide that their families will get the money from to help them out. But
well, if
it totally
suicide,
doesn't.
Though, yeah,
you
don't
get it.
Insurance
but
policy,
not many
yeah.
people realize that either.
Or they're just, you
depressed.
Know, so sad, yeah. Some farmers did kill themselves in an effort to leave behind a better place for their families. Others chose a different route, which brings me to the story we have today.
Would it be
murder? I was like, what are you going to do there? Yes, it may. Being Midwest girls, we know that Midwest is filled with small towns and lots and lots of rolling farmlands. The town's small population, obviously, because we grew up in Union, Missouri. You end up knowing everybody. You end up knowing everybody's business.
Yep.
You know where to go for certain things. You know that, you know, Billy Joe, who's Betty's first cousin's serving time for whatever, right? Like a little bit too much, if you ask me, but whatever. So the story I have for you today takes place in a town called Elkland, Missouri. Elkland is a small community located in Webster County, has a population of around 200.
Oh, wow.
Most of them are farmers.
Yeah.
Dairy farming was really big in this area, and the farms, like we had talked about earlier, had been passed down generation One of these well-known families to live and farm the area was a family known as the Buckner family. Steve Buckner, who was the son of a prominent dairy farmer, wanted to continue on with all that he'd ever known. And in 1979, he bought his own farm and married his high school sweetheart, Jan.
Aww.
Steve and Jan were well-liked in the community, and it wasn't long before they started building a family of their own. The first son, Kirk, was followed by three more boys, four boys, perfect for a farm, right? Family was now complete, and everyone around them loved them, loved their children. They had a great reputation in the community. The boys were really good. So, as is with all farms, as the boys grew, they became farmhands. So they're going to help their dad out work the farm.
Whether they want to or not, that's
exactly
what happens.
It's such a tough life. It really is. Up early, work all day, woo-wee.
Work before you eat.
Everything.
Yeah.
As the boys grew, so did the farmhands, as they would all work together to make the farm a success. And none of the family worked harder than the oldest boy, Kirk, who was now 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
Kirk was, by all standards, very loving to his mother and always lent a hand in helping with his little brothers. But that was if he wasn't working out on the land. So located just down the farm was Steve's sister, Julie, and her husband, Jim Schneck, who worked on their own dairy farm. The couple, who had been married for 11 years, had met through a local cattle organization. Now, how cute is that? It's like Tinder, but for farmers. You know what I mean? Like,
well,
the
80s? Only. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It just made me giggle.
Where'd you pick up your wife? At all the cattle.
Right.
She's a heifer.
Yeah, no. Picked up the cattle organization. Just like most of the folks around the area, both Julie and Jim were born and raised in Webster County. And they were doing the same thing by raising their two young daughters in the area. Both families were doing what all the Americans do. They're raising their children to be the best they can, working hard on the farm, you know, just trying to get by. Now, the mid-80s, of course, is about to hit, and that's going to affect both of them and their farms. Farmers were often selling off equipment dirt cheap to get back on their feet. They were actually the lucky ones who still had a farm and things to sell to get some money to help get by. Mm-hmm. By 1985, as many as 250 farmers were losing their farms a day.
Oh,
a day.
Could you imagine how devastating that would be?
No. I mean, what do you do? That's
you
all you do.
Anything.
Like, you went to high school, maybe? Like, do you have a high school diploma?
Well, let's see. Back in
the 80s, you farmed,
the people...
though. That's it. Like, that's all you do. You know what I mean? You don't have a skill set other than farming. So times were desperate, and the people were even more desperate. The Buckner family was just one of these families drastically affected. Steve Buckner had fallen 2 years behind his mortgage, and so now Steve is leaning more and more on his son, Kirk, to help with him, the farm. Young Kirk was often seen up and out the door before sunrise, working till the bus came and got him, picked him up, took him to school, got off the bus, and immediately went out and worked till sunset.
No 14-year-old should go through that kind of stress either. Physical and mental, because you know in the back of his mind, he's thinking, we're going to lose the farm.
As the oldest child, too, which would naturally get the farm. At that time, Steve's brother-in-law down the road, Jim Schneck, was not quite in the same circumstances. He was not in jeopardy of losing his farm. He managed his farm better. He clamped down, and things were tight, but they were nowhere...
He probably didn't take out any loans.
Nowhere near into the situation that Steve Buckner was in.
Did they own... land?
Well, Steve just bought that land himself.
Oh, okay.
So Jim, of course, wanted to help his wife's brother's family out. So when Steve would come to Jim and ask to borrow some farming equipment, Jim would, of course, agree. So when Steve would ask, Jim was always happy to comply. But as Steve continued to struggle, he begins to help himself to Jim's equipment without asking and without permission.
No.
Right. While the difficulty of the situation starts to become worse, it becomes clear to some that Steve is really not cut out to do farmland. We just talked about how much labor goes into keeping a farm going each day, every day. There's no days off. It rains. You're still out there. It snows. You're still out there, right? And you have to drought.
Animals still have to be
Yeah, there's bad. Just things that happen and that, you know, whatever. Terrible. I couldn't imagine. I'm
sick,
way too lazy
to be
a farmer.
Oh, God. I'm too lazy to be a housewife.
That's true. Okay.
I'm almost too lazy to be a podcaster.
No.
Really? Seriously?
I know. I know, dear. I know. Yeah. Now, Steve Buckner begins to rely on others to keep it going for himself, his wife, and their kids. The tension is building.
I can imagine.
Mm-hmm, as the family is starting to even rely on Jim and Jim's family even more. Their relationship, which was once very cordial, is starting to get a little bit toxic and a little stress going in there. Jim finally has had it. So he severs the relationship with Steve altogether. Think about how hard that is because you're married to Steve's wife. I mean, Jim's... That would be weird.
What about Paul? No.
Right?
No, no, that would be hard because not only do you have to take care of your family, mm-hmm. now you're being asked to
help out,
take care of another family.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's toxic. Get them out of there.
So they
good
clip the relationship. September 24th, 1987. Young Kirk Buckner is up early to do his morning chores before going to school for the day. It is 7:50 a.m., and he had finished all his farm work. He boards the bus for school, goes to school all day. The bus returns him home. A teacher of Kirk's actually remembers the boy as he turned to wave that day from the bus, and she waved at him. She always said, he was a good boy.
Good kid.
She recalls that she may have been the last to see him alive. It was about 4:30 in the afternoon as she waved him goodbye on the bus. The following day, September 25th, around 6 a.m., the 911 dispatch receives a phone call. 911, what is your emergency? A man says, I've been shot. The call is traced to the Schneck farm, and the voice on the phone is Jim. Police race to the scene, unaware. And, I mean, it's a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, Missouri,
right.
Population 200. So they had no idea what they were going to walk into. Officers carefully approach the house and nervously make their way into the house. They see Jim located on the floor. He's obviously injured. He's alive, but incoherent. It seems that Jim had been shot in the leg, and he's also been stabbed in the stomach.
Oh, my.
Nearby Jim is Kirk, Jim's teenage nephew. Kirk has gunshots and knife wounds to his body, and his right hand appears to be holding the weapon that was used in the massacre, a handgun.
Really?
Police are stunned at the sight, but the grisly scene is about to get much, much worse. As the police venture upstairs, they locate Jim's wife, Julie.
Mm-hmm.
She's dead. She was shot as she slept.
Mm-hmm.
Also upstairs are 6-year-old Mindy and 8-year-old Jamie, who are alive and unharmed.
Thank goodness.
Officers try desperately to try to get some answers from Jim, but due to his injuries and probably shock, he can't answer them.
No. I'm sure he's bleeding out with the stomach wounds.
He's pretty incoherent. So Jim is then airlifted to a local hospital. As the police work the scene, the sheriff must deal with informing Kirk's parents, who live down the road, Jan and Steve Buckner, that their oldest son has been killed. As the deputies pull into the drive, they prepare themselves for this terrible task. I cannot even imagine.
I couldn't either.
As they approach the front door, they notice it's pretty quiet for a farmhouse that should have some stuff going on that day. The sheriff opens the door and is greeted with a familiar smell and a dreadful sight. Blood is everywhere. Inside the Buckner home, Kirk Buckner's 3 younger brothers were all shot in the head. Execution style. The 2 older boys were shot while they slept in their bed, and the baby, only 2 years old, was shot in his playpen. Police searched the house, and Jan and Steve Buckner were nowhere to be found. So the police spread out, and they begin searching the farmland outside the house, immediately near the house and then going out farther. It's not too long before they locate Jan near the milk barn. She was shot in the back of the head and dropped where she stood. Steve Buckner is unaccounted for. And authorities are now starting to worry that maybe, just maybe, Steve might have ran and he might be the killer.
Right.
A manhunt is immediately launched.
A manhunt?
Mm-hmm. A manhunt. That's what's where men live in a hut.
Is that where they go to menstruate?
Mm-hmm. It is. Actually, it's very Gilligan's Island with the thing.
The coconut.
Mm-hmm.
Radios.
Mm-hmm. A manhunt is immediately launched. Roadblocks are put up everywhere and people start searching for Steve Buckner. Back at the crime scene, police begin to collect some evidence. Jim Shank's overalls were cut off him and sent to the lab for analysis. Also collected were the knife and the .22 caliber that was in Kirk Buckner's right hand as he lay dead on the floor. Blankets and clothing, as well as fibers, also all go off to the lab. Police separate out and begin to interview neighbors. One of the neighbors recalled hearing some screaming and gunshots around 4:55 a.m.
Wow, that had to be loud.
It was later that day, officials spot something in a field. The field actually joined the Buckner and the Schenck farms, and it had a cemetery kind of in the middle of the land. Lying there on his stomach was Steve Buckner. He had been shot twice in the back of the head. Mm. Police now know that Steve is not the killer.
No.
Obviously, you can't shoot yourself in the back of the head twice. But he is also a victim of this terrible crime. Authorities are perplexed as to who would want to harm these two hardworking farm families. The Buckner family was wiped out in its entirety, and Jim is struggling to come to terms with the loss of his wife, Julie, and his brother-in-law and family that lived down the road.
He's still alive.
He's alive. He's in the hospital. As he's recuperating in the hospital, he becomes well enough to give police some details about that early morning. Jim states that he woke very early in the morning as he needed to check on a cow that was due to have a calf, have a baby cow. He states that as he was coming back to the house, he saw some flashes inside the home. He could see a figure inside the house. As he opened the front door, he was greeted by a flash which struck him in the leg, and he stumbled. He reached for a knife and ran down the hallway, meeting the stranger in the house. The two of them scuffled, both desperate to get the gun and the knife and gain control of the situation. Jim stated he started swinging madly into the air and then the figure ending up hitting the person. He was sure he was stabbing him over and over, and then finally the stranger fell to the ground, became silent. Jim realized the stranger turned out to be not a stranger at all. It was Jim's nephew, Kirk Buckner. Police can now build a theory as to what happened that night, but they still don't have a motive. Police allege that Kirk Buckner began his rampage by murdering his mother first and then his father. He then went inside and killed his little brothers as they slept. Police then believe that Kirk got into his car and drove 5 miles to his Aunt Julie and Uncle Jim's home. Kirk entered the residence to find Julie and the two little girls sleeping. They say that they believe Kirk then killed Julie, but was interrupted as Jim returned home. Police begin to suspect that Kirk was becoming despondent over the farm, not doing too well, and in a desperate move, he took them out of their misery. They suspect he thought he was doing them a favor by
killing them all.
Police interview Kirk's classmates at school to see if they can shed any light on Kirk, maybe what was going on inside his head. One of Kirk's friends said that Kirk said his dad was lazy and that he would like to kill him. Now, Kirk was a very hard worker on the farm, putting in hours before and after school. And he had firsthand witnessed, obviously, the hardships that the land, keeping it up, was having. 2 years behind on a mortgage. That's pretty crazy, right? As the town was still reeling over this tragedy, the entire town, all of them, 200, came out to lay the family members to rest. The caskets were all lined up as an entire family was being laid to rest.
Well, now there's less than 200.
Jim Schenck, still recovering and unable to walk, watched the service from inside his truck. He would later recall that he didn't really remember that day, and all he felt was numb.
I can imagine.
Right? Well, he's got his two little girls still, but his wife, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, and 4 little boys.
3 little boys.
No, Kirk died too. You don't think he's a little boy?
He's a murderer is what he is.
He's a murderer.
And I don't know if he killed the man's wife, if he would really be remorseful that he was dead.
In what would be considered a goodwill gesture and probably something that a small town would do, but also not the smartest thing to do, neighbors came out to both farms and cleaned him up immediately, top to bottom. Partly in hopes that Jim would have a place to return back to that would not bring back any bad memories.
Right.
And then also to wipe out the horrible thing that happened on those farms.
Well, it's just like the old barn raising.
Yeah. So the town is slowly getting back to normal, or somewhat normal.
God, could you imagine?
No, the small...
The two old ladies on the party lawn talking about that. I knew that kid. I knew he was trouble from the minute I laid eyes on him.
Truth. That is until a phone call comes into the sheriff's office with some interesting information about Kirk Buckner.
Mm.
A teacher that had Kirk as a student wanted to confirm just one little small fact of the crime because it had been in the news, obviously. This confirmation would make the police start to question everything that they had theorized about the crime. Mm. The teacher asked which hand the gun was found in. Police told her the right hand. A silent pause followed. The teacher then informed the police that Kirk was indeed left-handed.
Mm.
Authorities begin to think about this. And then they start to realize, you know, there's a few other things that seem a little bit off about this crime. In the initial theory of the crime, it was thought that Kirk shot his father in the head, loaded him into the truck, drove him to the cemetery, and dragged him through the weeds. Now, the thing here, Kirk's only 14.
So small.
Itty bitty. So think about my kid, right, dragging a big guy. So here, now we get the measurements here.
And dead weight is heavier. I mean, a dead body weighs more.
Mm-hmm. So Kirk was only 14, and he was he was a slight kid, right? Boys always
But he was still... Remember some of the farm boys that we grew up with? They were skinny with the farmer tan, but they were
big
muscles. They had strong. Tons of
They're
muscles.
Very strong, yeah. Right? So,
but he couldn't have done it. He couldn't have taken a body there.
Kirk had a slight build, and he weighed around 135 pounds.
What?
His father, Steve, on the other hand, was a large guy weighing between 250 and 260. So police start to think that it was probably near impossible for this young man to drag his father's body the distance that it had been drug. Police start to take another look at some of the evidence. They start with the .22 caliber revolver handgun. I learned a little something about guns in the story. Mm-hmm. The six-shot revolver has a retaining pin that needs to be removed in order to reload the gun. You would then load the cylinder, put the cylinder back, and then insert the retaining pin to hold it in place when the gun was fired.
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing about guns. I had to Google a picture of this because I'm a visual person. I can't read stuff and get it. I got to see it. The gun will not fire without the cylinder pin being in position. That morning, there were 17 shots fired, but the gun was missing the cylinder pin. Police went in, searched the homes. They were hoping to find it in either of the houses.
But it had been cleaned.
But the neighbors had been in, scrubbed it, emptied it out. It was pretty much cleaned out. So police are starting to question everything now.
Right,
they're starting to rethink this because they really thought this was an open and closed case. As we talked about earlier, and as we know, we grew up in one. Everyone knows everyone, and everyone knows what's going on with everyone in a small town. So there'd been this rumor started to come about. You see where I'm going with this?
Mm-hmm.
Start to make its way around town.
How do rumors get started?
They're started by the jealous people.
They get mad?
For something somebody said?
They had, and somebody else has hold it.
Yeah, we did that in the DLU one. Sorry, whatever.
Well, hey, you know, jealousy is always...
Jealousy! Gin blossoms. Jealousy!
Jealousy!
Okay.
Which is about the time this came out, isn't it? Around?
Probably. Mm-hmm. It was rumor. Just a rumor. But it gave the police pause. Grieving widower Jim was having
an affair.
The hardworking farmer had a secret, but police were about to uncover it. Damn it, Jim. You got to see this guy, too, because I can't believe he got one girl, much less another one.
Jim Butler.
Did he wear
overalls?
Yep.
Jim Buckner, Vietnam.
Don't look his picture up yet.
I want to see.
About 2 years before the murders, Jim had a serious chest injury. He had made an appointment with a nurse practitioner named Nancy Bruner. The initial appointment was to last 15 minutes, but ended up turning into 4 hours.
4 hours?
Tour. A four-hour tour. Their chance meeting would soon turn into a full-blown affair. Police knew they had to talk to Nancy Bruner. Nancy stated when she met Jim, she was divorced with 2 children. She says they started to become close, only friends. But Jim would travel to Springfield, often telling Julie that he had a doctor's appointment. Nancy said she knew nothing about the shootings, and then that was it. The interview was over. The following day, police may have been surprised, maybe not so much, when they received a phone call from Nancy. Nancy called them to tell them that she had not been truthful about the interview.
No, well, at least she...
She had lied.
Oh. Mm. She called him to say she lied?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's ballsy.
She tells them that she and Jim were heavily involved, not just friends. And Jim had told her that he had plans to divorce Julie, and he would get custody of their girls. He would then marry Nancy, and they'd live together forever, happy.
Okay, ladies.
Running off into the sunset.
They never leave their wives.
As Nancy waited for these plans to come to, Jim was not quite living up to his promise to her. Julie decided to take matters into her own hands. She drives out to the house to meet Julie, and she tells Julie that Jim's cheating on her and that Jim had promised her that he was going to marry her. And Julie says, "We've never discussed divorce. Never been an option, never been discussed." Both of them are fuming mad.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously.
But they have a mutual enemy now, so they're not mad at each other.
So it becomes apparent there's a lot more to this than the authorities had originally thought. Kirk's autopsy would be revealing. Here we go. Put on your seatbelt, Jen. Pathologists discovered that Kirk, who was believed to have died from the gunshot wound and knife wound to his neck, did not die from that at all. He perished from a gunshot wound to the left ventricle of his heart, and this bullet entered his chest through his back. He was shot while facing away from the gun.
Coward.
Then he was shot again while he was on the ground. And it was that shot that went into his neck. Kirk Buckner was already dead when the gun was placed in his hand and the knife near his body. So how did the gun that was used to shoot Jim and also Kirk end up in Kirk's hand while Kirk was already dead?
I believe it was placed. I've seen enough Murder, She Wrote to know this.
It is now clear that Kirk was not the killer, and there's more evidence to show that maybe someone's not telling the truth. Let's take a moment to look at the crime evidence, shall we, Detective Jen? The crime lab examines Jim's pant leg and realized that the...
Now, was it his pant leg or was it his dicky overalls?
The crime lab examined Jim's pant leg and realized it had gunshot residue on it, but it was all inside the pant leg, meaning that Jim could have shot himself. The biggest discovery was about to be uncovered. Hidden inside his pant pocket, authorities found what they had been missing up to this point and could not locate: the cylinder retaining pin. The gun would not fire without the pin, and the only logical person to have that pin would be the murderer.
Right.
Jim was about to undergo a lie detector test when he broke down and confessed that he had committed the murders and tried to frame his dead nephew.
Isn't what an asshole.
Awful jerk.
And Kirk was such a sweet kid, too.
Appearing in court wearing bib overalls and a white t-shirt, he was charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder. During the interview, Jim finally reveals what occurred on that dark morning on September 26, 1987. Jim states that when he woke around 4 a.m. in the morning, Julie was still fuming mad over finding out about Jim's affair with Nancy. Julie, very upset, calls her brother Steve to come over and talk to her. You know, she needs a little support of family.
Mm-hmm.
Jim sees the lights of his car approach, and so he goes out to talk to Steve. Steve and Jim's talk soon turns into a big argument. Steve pulls a pistol on Jim. Now, Jim claims that Steve said at this point, "I can end this all right here, right now." Meaning, you know, he would kill Jim. Jim says that statement angered him and that they began fighting over the pistol. And there was a single shot that rang out and Steve went limp. Jim claims that he doesn't remember anything after that one shot, but self-defense is a bit questionable with Steve Buckner's 2 shots in the back of the head.
I was going to say, doesn't seem, especially if it's in the graveyard.
So
I was good at Clue.
Jim realizes there's a little problem. What's he going to do about Jan?
Mm-hmm.
Jan's Steve's wife, his sister-in-law by marriage. Jan knows that Steve went to Jim's house, so Jim must decide what to do with her. Jim drives to Jan's house, enters the resident, and shot Jan Buckner in the back of the head. Kirk, who was sleeping out in the family's camper, heard the shot. Kirk, obviously growing up on a farm and out there, he knew it was a gunshot. You know, freaked out, jumped out of the camper, and he was going to make a run for it because he knew something wasn't right. So he's running away. He's trying to escape, meaning going away. Previously, Jim had claimed it was self-defense, remember?
Mm-hmm.
But the shots and all that are starting to tell a different story. As Kirk is running away, he is shot in the back. Then he's shot again as he's lying on the ground. Jim then goes inside the house and shoots the other sleeping children. Why would you do that? Like, why are you going to shoot them? What's the point?
Because he doesn't want to raise them.
Oh, I didn't think about that. What a jerk.
Mm-hmm. It would be his responsibility, right?
Yes, it will be. Jim thinks he's finished, but as he's leaving the house, he notices that Kirk is still alive. So he picks up Kirk, puts him in the truck, and drives home to where his wife, Julie, is sleeping. So Jim now claims, and I mean claims, he went to go wake Julie and tell Julie about everything that just happened.
Oh, of course he was going to do that.
Because that's going to end well.
Honey, by the way, I killed your entire family.
Yeah, thank you. He, at this time, still has Kirk slung over his shoulder and the gun in his hand. Oops, gun goes off and shoots Julie in bed,
goodness.
Killing her.
That's awful. If only he would practice gun safety.
Jim then drags Kirk's body to the hallway, where he shoots him again two more times. So the scene is set, or so he thinks, but there's still one thing left to do. Jim must now shoot himself so that his story makes sense. He takes the gun and shoots himself in the leg. So all these people are brutally murdered, and the killer shoots himself in the leg. Think.
Coward.
You.
He shot all of them.
More
either
than...
He shot them either in the back or while they were sleeping.
Terrible.
He's a coward. That's what cowards do. Lizard-licking, yellow-bellied
belly sight sucker. Authorities believe they finally have a reason why Jim lost it and exploded and did all this to his family. They believe the pressure from the affair, the threat of divorce from his wife, Julie, his dealings with Steve, them losing the farm, him maybe having to take care of the family, all just came together and he exploded.
Mm-hmm.
There's also some thought that he may have killed his family to... with the hopes to receive some life insurance money, mm-hmm. although he denied that. So with the help of his confession, Jim Schneck is convicted on 3 counts of first-degree murder.
Only 3?
He was charged with 7, convicted of 3.
Okay.
I guess it's the 3 adults. The small town had seen nothing like this, so obviously the courtroom is packed on the daily.
Oh, I would bet.
The jury wanted the death penalty, and mm-hmm. they got it.
Good.
He was sentenced to die, but the Missouri Supreme Court overturned the convictions. With some heavy talks, Jim agreed to plead guilty, tell him everything about the murders, if the death penalty was taken off the table. Jim received 3 life sentences without parole. Jim now calls the Missouri State Pen home, and the small Missouri town has forever lost its innocence.
Did he ever tell the real story, though?
That's what I just told you, like, after
that
what he says. So I think, and I'd say that you would agree with me, I think the true sadness... it's awful these people were killed. But to blame your 14-year-old nephew?
Horrible.
Really? He thought this all out.
He had to have. I mean, how did... Okay, first of all, we know he didn't shoot his brother-in-law on accident.
No.
Because 2 shots to the back of the head.
Yeah.
Plus, he said it happened outside the home.
Mm-hmm.
And his body was found in the family cemetery that...
Farther away.
Farther away.
Yep.
So he would have to do something...
Mm-hmm. He had to drag him out there.
He had to drag
him out there, maybe. I don't know.
Well, if it was at least 5 miles away, right? Because you said
It was in between, so it was...
2.5.
Yeah, would guess 2-ish.
And the guy was how much? 250?
250 to 260.
Yeah.
So you know that Kirk didn't do that.
No.
I'm guessing that he just saw an opportunity. Like, he killed them all and then saw the opportunity to blame the kid. But I guess the ding-dong didn't realize that he had the wrong hand. Put the gun in the wrong hand.
No.
You think you know what you're, you know?
No, you wouldn't.
I would, I but
so.
You know. I go,
oh. But you're a girl. You pay attention to that kind of stuff.
What else do I love?
Well, you love lefties and righties, but I'm also saying
not
that
righties. I love lefties.
You love all men. Doesn't matter what hand they are. You just prefer the left hand. But anyway, a man wouldn't know if they were left and right. I mean, if you would ask my husband what his nephew, what dominant hand he wouldn't know. He would just assume it was right because most people are right-handed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I would know
because
I pay attention to that kind of stuff.
Right. As do I.
Yeah, but what an asshole.
Right.
So what happened to Nancy? Anything?
No. Like, she had nothing to do with it. But,
yeah.
I mean, I think...
Well, thank God she, like, called back and said.
Yeah.
But she said at the time she didn't know that it happened, correct?
Yeah, she didn't know. Like, she knew nothing about the murders.
Because she lived in Springfield, Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was looks like a good...
Distance away.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I do believe up until that time, to that date in the 80s, that was the largest mass massacre in Missouri.
Family annihilator.
Yeah,
is what
like
it would
that.
Be called. In Missouri or just?
No,
it would
just
have
in
to
Missouri.
Be in Missouri.
Yeah, it was just Missouri. But still, there's other ones now that have taken that place.
Unfortunately, yeah. Wow.
I looked it up, but I'm not going to share in case I want to do one of those.
Come on, look at you, secret keeper.
It's like, did you like that one?
I did. I never knew about that
one. Me neither.
And that was probably, what, 5 hours away? 5 hours, 6 hour drive?
Yeah, but I'm just thinking that it was probably due to our age because we were junior in high school-ish.
We're about 16.
So we wouldn't have...
Going on junior year. Yeah, we were too self-involved right at that point.
Yeah.
Didn't even know.
Duh. What are we going to do Friday night? We're going to go to the game. All right, Jen, that's all I got, buddy.
It was good. I enjoyed it. I had never heard of that one. Now that you mentioned Farm Aid, I do remember how horrible the farmers had it.
Yeah, because I forgot about all that, and I forgot like how and why it happened, so I needed to know. All right, Jen, you can catch us on Facebook, Twitter. Jen loves to talk on Twitter. That's it. So remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
That was generated by the architecture they grew. Now we're facing...
The architecture?
Agriculture. Because you know why? You know why? Because you messed me up with your... I got to start over. Agriculture. Sorry. And that's why I looked at you, because I was like, that's not right.
That's not right. I know. And it's one of those words that you know...
Well, now that like I interchanged them to make fun, that we messed that up.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm just going to start over.
Okay. But you did. My liquor bill is going to get huge, like my liver. All right.
The front part of this at mm-hmm. the top might be a little boring, but sometimes like I
sometimes
start...
all of yours is boring, but I still pretend to be happy.
It's true.
And
it's true.
I need to get Reggie into the beauty shop, man, because he's stinky.
Thank you, man.
It's about time. He goes once a month.
Okay. That's how often I shower.
I know. Trust me. I knows it.
14. This little boy worked just a little hard off. Hard off. Hard out.
Hard on.
Hard-ish. Hard out. There we go. Shut up, Jen. So with the difficulty of this situation.
Difficulty.
I know. And I said so. The call is traced to the Schenck farm, and the voice on the phone is Jim Schenck. Schenck. Jim Schenck. Jesus. It's that dude that's got a farm.
You're thinking Schick because you shaved Schick. Your legs today.
That is correct. That's so true. Lord.
At least you're not saying Sheer.
I don't mean where.
Jim
or
Sheer,
shit.
Or Van Leer.
Oh, Van Leer.
Fink.
Oh, Lord.
Jim Fink.
Yep. He's a farmer. You know how he lost him.
Okay. He's married to Terry.
Tierra. Okay, stop it. I'm gonna start that all over.
We're going to hell.
We are going now. I just like I said yesterday, I want to go to the middle place. I want to have fun, the medium place, right?
When you're watching The Good Life?
Yes. I don't want to be with the
Good Place.
Good Place.
I right. told you to watch that a long time ago.
Yeah, I won't talk about that. Okay.
You forking wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Piece of shirt.
Okay, stop.
It's a great show. Okay. And I love Kristen Bell, too.
I love her.
Have you ever seen the video where Dax set her up to go pet a sloth?
Sloth, and she's crying. She's pregnant. That's why. Like,
I know,
even
but
more.
Still. Yeah.
Okay.
Love her.
I do, too. She cracks me up.
No.
Any day.
So
police begin.
That's a lot of houses there, Camille.
I'm sorry, because you know. Okay, let's do that again. You want to do that again? You want to do that again?
Yeah,
you want to do that again?
He went to the house, and then in the house, they said the house, and then the thing in the house, and then they came in the house.
And the double-wide trailer, camper.
No, just
condo,
say.
Duplex, place. House, villa, vacation home.
Casa.
Casa Gallardo. Okay.
Schnick, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't know. I can't read that word.
S-C-H-N-I-C-K, so it would be schnick.
Do I have to redo the whole damn thing?
It's not... It's schnick instead of...
Okay, I'm just going to go by Jim now, and then I'll change it. Okay, so wait. What is it again?
It's schnick. Jim Schnick.
S-C-H-N-I-C-K.
Schnick, like schnooks.
No.
Schnick.
Okay, I'm going with Jim.
Not
going with Jim.
Because shink is S-H...
Whatever, don't mess me up again.
Okay.
I'm just going to go with Jim.
Maybe his name is Paul Schink.
Schick.
Schnick. Schnick, like
schnooks. I'm going with Jim.
Okay.
Damn it, Jim. Jen?
It's the Jim.
Jen?